worship Allah, to do litanies and supplications. It is difficult for the average person. And so this is why it is so valuable when somebody does do this. But let's say it's very difficult for us to do these things. Remember, these are supurgatory things. They are mustahab. They are recommended. They are not wajib. They are not obligatory. But then let us do our best to fulfill the wajib things that we must do, the obligatory prayers that we must pray. We need to try our very best to make sure that we are reciting these prayers, reciting these supplications, especially the ones which are wajib and are obligatory. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 3 of the Quran in verse number 33 makes an announcement where he says inna Allah astafa, verily God has chosen Adam and then Nuh and then the family of Abraham, and then Imran, alal alameen, over the rest of the people in the world. When you look at this verse of the Quran, you come to realize that all human beings have been created by Almighty God, but they are not equal in the eyes of God. As far as their status is concerned, you know, when it comes to the prophets of God, the messengers of God, those who represent Him in conveying His message, they are at a higher, you know, status than other human beings. I would like to take this opportunity to actually talk about the special status that God has given to Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. Of course, we have some, Wahhabi-minded scholars like Ibn Taymiyyah and others. But if you look at the commentators of the Sunni books of Hadith, including those who have written the Ahadith, the narrations of the Prophet, commentaries from the books like Bukhari and others. One statement I would like to quote from Ibn Hajar in Fath al-Bari, which is a commentary of Sahih Bukhari, also from Qastalani, another commentary of the book of Bukhari, where he says, إِنَّ كُلَّ طَرِيقٍ مِنْهَا صَالِحٌ لِلْإِحْتِجَاجِ فَضْلًا عَنْ مَجْمُوعَهَا. He says, each narration in this story of the door of Ali be left open, by itself these narrations are so authentic that they can be used as an argument in favor of Ali. Let alone when you put all the narrations together, they become even strong in authenticity and implications. Couple of more, statements from the Prophet on this issue, where he says, and it seems this is all from the same, speech that he gave after the complaints that the people heard about it. In one, he says, أَلَا لَا يُحِلُّ هَذَا الْمَسْجِدِ بِجُنُوبٍ وَلَا لِحَائِضٍ إِلَّا لِرَسُولِ اللَّهِ وَعَلِي وَفَاطِمَةَ وَلَحَسَنَ وَلَحُسَيْنَ. He says, this masjid is not permissible for anyone in this state of impurity for them to come in. Except the rule is, the exception goes for the Messenger of Allah, the Prophet himself, and for Ali, and for Fatima, and Hassan and Hussein. It's important that he gives the names, because he says, عَلَىٰ قَدْ بَيَّنْتُ لَكُمُ الْأَسْمَاءَ أَنْ لَا تُضِلُّ. He says, I made sure that I give you the names, these five names, so that you do not go astray. And this is from the Sunni source. Al-Bayhaqi in his As-Sunan actually talks about it. And so the Prophet actually gave the names of Panjatan, as we call them, the five holy ones. That their status, even on a physical level, is different from the status of the rest of the human beings.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The Palestinian Health Ministry in the Gaza Strip held a press conference to attract global attention on the sufferings of the cancer patients in the enclave due to the Israeli siege. The closure of borders has increased pressure on the patients, ending either with their death due to the lack of treatment services in Gaza hospitals or unjustified restrictions imposed on movement for patients who need treatment across borders.
Due to the closure of borders, I can't travel abroad for treatment. The treatment here is limited and sometimes not available at all. Human rights groups should put pressure on Israel to let us travel abroad for treatment.
While almost 2,000 new cases are being diagnosed with cancer each year, 60% of them need to travel abroad for treatment, which is denied by Israel. The ministry has recorded more than 3,000 deaths among cancer patients over the past 5 years.
When I was first diagnosed with pancreas cancer, my permission to leave Gaza was issued immediately. But Israel delayed my travel for more than 2 months, and that led to the spreading of the cancer in my body.
The health ministry in Gaza calls on the international community to pressure Israeli occupation to lift these restrictions on patients and facilitate their access to specialized hospitals outside Gaza to enhance opportunities for their urgent treatment.
Unfortunately, 60% of our patients, which we use to do the referral for them, they usually do not get a permission from the Israeli side to leave the Gaza to receive their treatment. Sometimes this permission usually delayed for 2 to 3 months. When the case become very, very complicated, United Nations and all the people who are looking for peace in the area to interfere very strongly in this issue, to force the Israeli side to not to put all these pressures on the on the cancer patients and to issue their permission very urgently, freely, because this is a humanitarian issue. This is not a political issue.
The usual Israeli restrictions and movement, along with preventing the entry of medicines, have doubled the suffering of cancer patients in Gaza and practically denied access to medical treatment, posing a threat to their lives. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
After gaining control over more than 200 districts in Afghanistan, the Taliban now seem to have a bigger plan that is capturing provincial centers across some strategic areas of the country.
The militants recently launched heavy attacks on centers of Herat, Kandahar and Helmand provinces in western and southern Afghanistan. But Afghan forces, mainly the commando troops and Afghan Air Force, plus local armed fronts, pushed back the Taliban from the entrance gates of these strategic cities.
Mohammed Ismail Khan, locally known as Amir Saib, is 78 years old. He is a popular political and jihadi leader in Afghanistan. He and thousands of his followers have decided to pick up guns and defend their home city, Herat, in western Afghanistan, which was on the verge of collapse by Taliban. Ismail Khan believes that one of the main reasons behind the sharp advances of Taliban is the legitimacy granted to them by Washington under the U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
The U.S. began talks with the Taliban and granted them political legitimacy. That's why many countries are supporting the Taliban, but will not sit idle and will continue our fight against them.
The Taliban have so far failed to gain control over provincial centers in southern and western Afghanistan. But the rise of war has prompted thousands of local villagers like Golgotai to flee their houses in search of shelter.
I have lost my husband and two of my sons in Taliban's attacks on our district. We are deprived of any humanitarian aid by the government. We are tired of war. Please stop fighting for the sake of God.
In such circumstances, the Afghan government simultaneously insists on continuation of peace talks with the Taliban negotiating team in Doha and strengthening war fronts against the Taliban to retake the lost areas that cover nearly half of districts in Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Tunisia's political crisis and rising tensions in the country have sparked reactions from countries across the globe. Tunisian President Kais Saied held a phone call with his Algerian counterpart Abdelmajid Tebboune and discussed the latest developments. Saied assured him that Tunisia is on the right path to establish democracy and that there will be important decisions soon. The Egyptian government has also said it is following with great interest what's happening in Tunisia and what authorities are doing there to achieve security and stability. Last week, the Tunisian president invoked emergency powers to seize control of the government, remove the prime minister, and freeze parliament.
The president used the provisions of the constitution and he respected the law. But some people in Tunisia say this was a coup. The president should respect the human rights and follow the constitution.
President Kais Saied has held meetings at the presidential palace with ministers of foreign affairs of Libya, Morocco, Algeria and Saudi Arabia. They were briefed on the latest developments in Tunisia and affirmed their support for the Tunisian people and for the recent decisions of the president. Tunisian President Kais Saied also affirmed his commitment to bear in the trust and responsibility of protecting the country and confronting all attempts to strike and fragment it. The European Union has called for the resumption of Tunisian parliamentary activity as soon as possible. It also urged the political parties in Tunisia to respect the constitution and avoid violence.
Tunisian people are waiting for Saied to name a new prime minister to line out a roadmap after he invoked emergency powers. This will determine the next step and what lies ahead for the country's future. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
We are all against the health pass. That was the main slogan that brought together many protesters all over France. For the third week in a row, they continued marching against the government's decision to put in place a health pass for all citizens. This is an electronic document that every citizen has to show in public places that proves that they are vaccinated or have a negative PCR test. Medical figures are crystal clear. In European countries where the majority of its population is vaccinated, like the UK, the Netherlands, Denmark or Ireland, the COVID virus and its Delta variant are under control. So why are these protesters taking the street again?
I am in favor of the vaccination, not for this one, because we have not enough information about this vaccine. So I am in favor of the vaccination, but I am against the health path. We have our liberties and no one should tell us what we should do or not.
In hospitals, doctors say that the new wave of people with severe COVID symptoms are all non-vaccinated persons. In Martinique and La Réunion, two overseas French territories, a new lockdown has begun, given that very few people are vaccinated. The vaccination campaign has accelerated the last 3 weeks. In France now, more than 50% have received two jabs of the vaccine. So is it responsible to protest against these mandatory measures?
Only science will tell us, and science needs time to be proven efficient. So we need more time to see what's really happening.
I am not against the vaccine itself. I am more against the health pass and the political use of it. If the government had given sufficient means to health workers and hospitals to handle the COVID crisis, it would have been more efficient.
3,000 police officers have been mobilized to control all the marches today in the French capital. There were some clashes. It's amazing to see so many protesters on the street at the start of the holiday season. Some say that with these protests against the authoritarian measures of the French government, the Yellow Vest movement rose from its ashes. Despite clear indications that vaccination is effective in reducing symptomatic cases and deaths from COVID-19, protests continue in France, but rather against a mandatory health pass considered as a violation of individual liberties rather than against the vaccination itself. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
A new victory against the Saudi-backed militant groups was made by Yemen's armed forces in the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sari'a, said Nu'man and Nata' regions of the country's central province of Al-Bayda were fully liberated from the control of the Saudi-backed terrorists. He said the military operation had left hundreds of Saudi-backed militants killed and injured, adding that the Yemeni forces had also captured a number of the militants.
Our armed forces have completed the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation, which led to the liberation of the districts of Nate'e and Nu'man and the defeat of the elements of the militant groups associated with the Saudi-led coalition and inflicting heavy losses on them, while hundreds of them were killed, wounded and captured.
Sari'a also said the Yemeni forces have confiscated militants' weapons, which are U.S.-made, according to military experts. They say this is yet another proof of the U.S. military support for Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists in Yemen.
This operation proved that the United States supports terrorist groups, whether militarily or through statements accusing the Yemeni army of hampering the peaceful solutions. America is the one who directs and controls the terrorist groups. Today, there is a lot of evidence proving Washington's support for terrorist groups, including American-made weapons that the Yemeni army seized during the recent operation.
2 weeks ago, the Yemeni army took control of large areas in Al-Bayda, the first stage of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation that was launched on July 13th. The operation was part of military efforts to push members of Al-Qaeda and Daesh out of their strongholds in Al-Bayda.
Observers say the U.S. support for the terrorist groups in Al-Bayda is aimed at hampering the Yemeni army's advances toward Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. However, the Yemeni army says it will continue the operations until the liberation of all Yemeni territories and putting an end to years-long Saudi-imposed war. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
There is no evidence of institutional racism in the UK, says a report commissioned by the British government, but a landmark art exhibition on the doorsteps of Queen Elizabeth II paints a very different picture.
War in the Babylon is the title of this exhibition about black communities and their long struggle against systemic racism here in the UK. It comes 10 years after the police killing of unarmed black man Mark Duggan on the streets of London, with the aim of shining a light on his family's struggle for justice, as well as many more families who have lost a loved one at the hands of the British state.
Since 1990, there have been 1,433 people who have died in police custody. While the majority of deaths are white British, there is a disproportionate overrepresentation of black people who die as a result of use of force or restraint by the police.
10 years since the killing of Mark Duggan, but in 2015, in Haringey, the same borough, they killed Jermaine Baker. Last week, we had a notice put out that another person of colour, black person, has been killed in Haringey by the same police.
Stafford Scott, the curator of the exhibition, and who supported many of these families in their fight for justice, designed the showcase to illustrate how systemic racism is not just present in the police force, but something that permeates through different institutions in British society.
The War in the Babylon is an exhibition that we hope encapsulates the entirety of the black experience in the UK. You'd have recently heard this foolishness from some report by some geezer called Tony Sewell that said that there's no such thing as institutional racism in this country. War in the Babylon says that that's an absolute lie and provides the absolute evidence that that is a lie.
The pictures, videos and texts present an account for those whose voices are often not heard, or worse still, willfully ignored by the mainstream.
We're at the Mall. That's the same address as the Queen of England, the Queen of England resides. We've moved the front line in the fight against racism and the fight for truths and rights from off of the estates, from out of the hood, and we've taken it right to the heart of the establishment.
The need for exhibitions like this is as pertinent now as it's ever been, especially as the British government expands policies like racially disproportionate blanket stop and search, while simultaneously denying the existence of institutional racism, signalling to black communities in the UK that their historic fight for equality is far from over. Ahmed Kabella, London.
Palestinians accused Israel of using unjustified deadly force against Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank. In its latest report, Defense for Children International Palestine stated that the Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian children with no recourse or accountability. In its report, DCI Palestine revealed that evidence it has obtained shows children killed didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers at the time of their killing. The group says that Israeli forces used lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killing. killings.
Killing unarmed minors amounts to war crime and even crime against humanity. Israeli soldiers act in line with shoot-to-kill policy, opening fire to kill Palestinian children. The troopers know their military establishment will hold any of them accountable for killing innocent Palestinians.
On Friday, a 17-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Tamimi, was fatally shot by live ammunition in his back during a peaceful anti-settlement protest that was held in Nabi Saleh town, West Ramallah. Meanwhile, on Monday, a 17-year-old Yusuf Nawaf Mhareb, a resident of the Ramallah area village of Abwin, succumbed to wounds he had sustained a prayer when he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a protest against Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts say that under international law, the use of lethal force during a protest is allowed only when a direct and lethal threat to life or of serious injury exists. And as usual, Israel continues violating international law, including rules which limit the intentional lethal use of firearms, in particular against children.
Israeli forces have a twofold purpose by targeting Palestinian children. First, they want to intimidate Palestinian children to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli activity, and second, to oppress the Palestinians in general, to impose and strengthen the Israeli military control.
Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian minors were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition. Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warn that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Qalibov, has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Qalibov said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Qalibov held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hamoud Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbagh referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism, which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibov also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people. The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that. That yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws, but it cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machinaries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly the events of December 12, 2015 is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Anjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The U.S. Justice Department on Friday, 30th of July, sued the state of Texas over Governor Greg Abbott's executive order prohibiting the transport of migrants, arguing that the order violates the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution and jeopardizes the health and safety of migrants, federal immigration personnel, and communities at large. The article you're about to hear has been written by Claire Hansen, a writer and journalist who covers immigration and gun policy at U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, Justice Department Sues Texas Over Abbott's New Immigration Order, Kicking Off Legal Battle. Justice Department on Friday, 30th of July, sued the state of Texas over Governor Greg Abbott's executive order prohibiting the transport of migrants, arguing that the order violates the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution and jeopardizes the health and safety of migrants, federal immigration personnel, and communities at large. The Justice Department is also asking a judge to immediately block the implementation of the order. The lawsuit marks the start of one of the first major legal battles between the Biden administration and a Republican-led state over immigration. Under former President Donald Trump, legal fights over immigration policy between Democratic-led states and the federal government became so common as to be almost automatically expected with the introduction of new policies. Governor Greg Abbott's order, issued on Wednesday, 28th of July, seeks to make it illegal to provide ground transportation to a group of migrants who have been detained by immigration officials for crossing the border illegally, or who would have been expelled from the country under current border policy. The directive instructs law enforcement to stop any vehicle on reasonable suspicion of doing so, and also authorizes the state to impound vehicles. Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, cites the COVID-19 pandemic and the potential spread of the virus as the basis of the order. The recent order appears aimed at non-governmental organizations that often transport migrants from Customs and Border Protection, CBP stations, to shelters and other destinations, as well as at Greyhound buses, which are frequently used by migrants to travel after being released from federal custody. Both sometimes operate under contract or in connection with the federal government. The order is the latest in a string of increasingly restrictive immigration actions taken by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who is running for re-election in 2022 and has been coy about his potential candidacy for president in 2024. The immigration actions have asserted Texas's place as a leader in red state opposition to the Biden administration, a role Texas has played in recent decades when Democratic presidents were in power. Attorney General Merrick Garland wrote to Governor Greg Abbott on Thursday, 29th of July, and warned that the Justice Department would sue the state if he did not rescind the order. On Friday, Merrick Garland made good on that threat. The lawsuit argues that the order violates the federal government's broad authority over immigration enforcement and will severely disrupt the federal government's efforts to carry out its responsibilities under the federal immigration laws. Texas order prohibiting the ground transportation of migrants would disrupt many functions of Customs and Border Protection, CBP, ICE, and other agencies and lead to overcrowding and other issues, putting non-citizens' health at risk during the pandemic, the lawsuit argues. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, rely on third parties and partners to transport migrants between locations. And the federal government also contracts with groups to transfer unaccompanied migrant children from Customs and Border Protection facilities, which are inappropriate places to keep minors, to shelters run by non-governmental sponsors and contracted by the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement. The executive order's restriction on transportation will result in immediate backups of unaccompanied children at both CBP and ORR facilities. Increased density in these facilities will endanger unaccompanied children and facility personnel by increasing the risk of COVID-19 transmission, preventing unaccompanied children from being placed in the most appropriate facility, and delaying unaccompanied children's release to their sponsors, the lawsuit says. Advocates and non-governmental organization workers immediately balked at the order when it was issued on Wednesday, saying it could have catastrophic consequences and leave vulnerable migrant families, including children, stranded at bus stations and other locations with nowhere to go. Advocacy and legal groups are expected to challenge the order as well. Analysts say the order is rife with fraught legal questions and is similar to a spate of state laws passed a decade ago that were ultimately struck down by courts of law. I feel like I can hear the lawsuits writing themselves, says Karen Tumblin, the founder of Justice Action Center and an immigration litigator who challenged in court somewhat similar laws, including Arizona's infamous SB 1070 that created state crimes and penalties for illegal immigration. It's really surprising that Texas is creating this executive order that is on such clearly unconstitutional legal ground, she says. Experts say that Governor Greg Abbott's order may unconstitutionally preempt the federal government's near total authority over the implementation and enforcement of immigration law, as the Justice Department's lawsuit argues. The Supreme Court in 2012 struck down several provisions of SB 1070, ruling that they interfered with the federal government's superior authority to enforce immigration law. Outside of certain enumerated immigration powers given to the states, immigration enforcement is a federal power under the law, Tomlin says. This is a federal power, and state efforts to take away is a violation both of the federal government's power but also a violation of the rights of U.S. citizens, she said. In addition, federal courts, including the Supreme Court, have indicated that the authorities cannot draw a conclusion about a person's legal status based solely on their physical appearance, says Muzaffar Chishti, senior fellow at the nonprofit Migration Policy Institute and the director of the organization's office at New York University School of Law. With few exceptions, say if a bus were picking up passengers right outside a CBP, Customs and Border Protection station, it's unclear how authorities would have reasonable suspicion that a vehicle was transporting migrants. The implementation of this order is very problematic, just because it will be based on racial or ethnic profiling, which is constitutionally suspect, Chishti says. Unlike previous laws, Governor Greg Abbott's order was issued during the pandemic, and he nominally justified the order as an emergency response to the spread of COVID-19. But that basis may actually make it more difficult for Texas to defend the order, according to Muzaffar Chishti. The Justice Department lawsuit does not challenge the pandemic-related basis of Governor Greg Abbott's order, though future lawsuits by other groups may. If his real concern is health, as he seems to be suggesting, then in the legal analysis it is hypocritical because all of his other health policies on COVID seem to go in the other direction, Muzaffar Chishti says. Texas not only does not have a mask mandate or measures, Governor Greg Abbott has actually prohibited stores, schools, local governments, and other entities from implementing required COVID-19-related mitigation measures.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو ذا الرحمن الله هو ذا المنان. لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuhu. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you, as usual, from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Murtada Karim, who is a researcher at the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Dear Sheikh, today's topic is quite relevant, especially today when we have an imam who is in occultation. And the question is as follows. We know that in Islam and as Shia Muslims, we believe that following the orders, or just generally following a person who is not an imam, who is not an infallible imam, In every case, is not legal. It is not Islamically lawful. And to this extent, we have a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam saying, إِيَّاكَ أَن تَنْصَبَ رَجَلًا دُونَ الْحُجَّةِ فَتُصَدِّقَهُ فِي كُلِّ مَا قَالَ, saying that do not, or be wary of following a man who is not the Hujjah. And Hujjah here we interpret it as being the Imam. Then you believe him in everything he says. So following this logic there, Sheikh, we cannot then choose a leader or follow a leader who is not an infallible imam. And here is the natural question. We believe in the Wilayatul Faqih, the leadership of the most knowledgeable scholar in Iran, for example, and in other places. How then can we gather between these two narrations? How then can we gather between this narration that says we can only follow an infallible imam, and then we turn around and believe in a leader who is not an infallible imam? Please elaborate for us, dear Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The first part of the question, as you mentioned, is that following a person who is not infallible is not allowed. I believe that this cannot be accepted for all the cases. For example, we are talking about the religion of Islam. In the Battle of Badr, for example, the Holy Prophet chooses some commanders.
Right.
And under there are, some soldiers fighting under these commanders. Now the question is that during the war, should the commands of those commanders be followed by the soldiers or not? In the Battle of Karbala, for example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam has chosen Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas as a commander. Should his commands be obeyed by other companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam or not?
Right.
I think the answer is positive.
It's pretty obvious that they should follow.
At least during the war, the commands of the people introduced by an infallible person like the Prophet and Imam Hussein alayhi salam should be obeyed by others. So the first part of the question reads, following a person who is not infallible is not allowed. The answer is that this is not necessary and the case in all the cases. We have some examples when especially a person introduced by the Prophet, by the Imam, by an infallible, and he mentions that we need to follow him in these issues. For example, when it comes to issues related to war, for example. So this is the first point. The second point is an analysis of this narration which has been quoted in by Sheikh Kulaini in Al-Kafi. First of all, when it comes to the chain of the narration, it's not an authentic chain. But let's forget about the chain and analyze the content. The understanding of those people who have referred to this narration to talk against the concept of Wilayat al-Faqih is absolutely wrong. They did not understand the narration. Let me read for you the whole narration. Abu Hamza Thumali, the great companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, says that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told me that Iyaka an tata'a aqab al-rijal, meaning that be a way to follow the men, to accept whatever all the men say. قال قلت جعلت فداك. Abu Hamza says that I told the Imam, أما أعقاب الرجال فما ثلث ما في يدي إلا مما وتعت أعقاب الرجال. Interestingly, he says that my knowledge, two-thirds of it comes from those people who have narrated narrations from you or the previous Imam. They are among these rijal. They are not infallible.
Right.
So this is the question of Abu Hamza Thumali. If you mean that I need only to accept whatever I hear from an infallible imam, this is not possible. Two-thirds of what I know is what I have heard from other people who have narrated from you or other imams.
Exactly, yes.
Maybe this is also the understanding of some of those people who have used this narration to reject the concept of Wilayat Faqih.
They use the same logic here,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah. And the Imam explains that فَقَالَ لِي Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told me لَيْسَ هَيْثُ تَذْهَبْ. This is not the true understanding of what I meant. إِيَّاكَ أَن تَنْصِبَ رَجُلًا دُونَ الْحُجَّ فَتُصَدِّقَهُ فِي كُلِّ مَا قَالَ. Now, دون الحجة, some people, these people, they have understood the narration as referring to those people who are not hujja, who are not imam. But this is wrong. أن تنصب رجلا دون الحجة. دون الحجة means without a proof.
Exactly, without evidence.
Without evidence. So Imam says that be away from appointing a person to accept whatever he says without any reason, without any proof, and accept whatever he is telling you. What does Imam mean? Imam is, oh Abu Hamza, oh Abu Hamza. If you hear a narration from Zurara, who is quoting me, then you are accepting the narration of Zurara with a hujjah. You have a proof because I have already told you that you can hear from Zurara, or you know that Zurara is a trustworthy person. So you have a hujjah. You have
a argument proof. That proof, evidence that supports.
On the day of judgment, yes. If Allah asks you, why did you act upon the sayings of Zurara, you know, you argue that he was a trustworthy person. He quoted from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So dun al-hujjah in this narration means acting without proof. It doesn't mean choosing a person who is not hujjah.
Right.
It is a wrong understanding of the narration. So when we understand this narration in a true sense of the word, it means that we should not follow a person and act upon his sayings if we do not have any proof, any hujjah. Is it the case for Wilayat al-Faqih? Exactly, the point is that for Wilayat al-Faqih, we have enough proofs and hujjah from the narrations of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam himself and other Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, who have told us that during the major occultation, you need to follow what we call it today, Wali al-Faqih, the jurist, the most knowledgeable jurists who are pious, and so on and so forth. Let me, it's not the place to discuss about the concept of Wilayat al-Faqih, but just to mention and clarify that we have...
Because it is another topic with its own philosophy and evidence and arguments.
Just to mention that following a Wali al-Faqih is based on some proof and hujjah. I mentioned few narrations, famous narrations in this regard.
Please do.
For example, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam is quoted as saying the famous narration that فَأَمَّا مَنْ كَانَ مِنَ الْفُقَهَاءِ, those jurists who are the protectors and guardians of the religions, of the religion of Islam, they are away from committing sins, they are against following their vain desires, then other people need to follow them. This is in Bihar al-Anwar, volume 2, page 88. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the same imam that this narration was quoted from, he says that a person who rejects the verdict of such a person that I mentioned, this jurist who might be al-Wali al-Faqih, it is as if he is rejecting me, he is rejecting us, the Ahlul Bayt. And those who reject us, it is as if they are rejecting Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
To that extent, mashallah.
Al-Kafi, volume 1, page 67. And many other narrations which are mentioned, dear listeners who want to know about the concept of Wilayat al-Faqih, they can search. And there are many narrations mentioned by, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, advising the people, encouraging the people to refer to the jurists, the knowledgeable ones, the men of piety, and during the major occultation, and follow them.
Exactly. So in addition to that, when the 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, he went into occultation, the first time he went into occultation, he had four deputies who acted on behalf of him. So it's not a concept that we have invented recently, and innovation, as some people say, it's a bid'ah.
And interestingly, for example, at the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we see that and the other Imam, they have some special companions, great companions. For example, let me mention a person, a great companion of the Imam called Aban ibn Taghlib. Imam alayhi salam tells Aban ibn Taghlib that it is not the time of the occultation, the Imam is present. But Imam says to Abu Nabil Taqlib that sit in the mosque, the city of Medina, Masjid al-Nabi, and after give fatwa to the people. So those people who refer to Abu Nabil Taqlib, now they have a hujjah and proof. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam has introduced you to us, So if we follow what you mentioned, it means that we are following Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And this companion is so great that even Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that you can give fatwa. It doesn't mean that he has his own fatwas. He means that his knowledge is so great that whatever he's telling the people, it is like...
It's in accordance with what I would say.
Exactly. So when we say that we need to follow Waliyyul Faqih, it is because of the fact that the infallible imams, they have told us to do so. So following Waliyyul Faqih means in our time and era following an infallible imam, because the infallible imam, Imam al-Sadiq, Imam al-Askari, and Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam himself, I believe in his letter to Ali ibn Muhammad Samuri, his last deputy, mentions this point as well. Also, we have a tawqif from Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam referring to that. So it is not antansiba rajulan dun al-hujja. No, if we
that's not the meaning of it.
Yeah, if you are following today's Waliyyul Faqih, it is with hujja, with proof, and I only mentioned some of these proofs in our narrations. Let me also introduce a book. You know that, again, let me refer to the fact that the concept of Waliyyul Faqih, as you rightly mentioned, is not an innovated concept. It's been mentioned in the narrations, and some of the Shia scholars during the history, they have mentioned this topic in their books. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, he has a very comprehensive book known as Walayatul Faqih. In it, he has discussed about the concept of Walayatul Faqih. He has gathered all the narrations. And the point is that many Shia scholars believe that following a Waliyyul Faqih is not only proved through the verses and narrations. Rather, we have intellectual arguments which tell us that we need to follow a marji' taqlid. So we should not think that the proof, the hujjah that we have is limited to these narrations. According to great Shia scholars, we have also intellectual argument and hujjah and proof. So our dear listeners can search about this topic and find more about the intellectual arguments for this as well.
We can also put this in, paint this picture in another way, because when we say Waliyyul Faqih, we maybe perhaps do not understand exactly what a Waliyyul Faqih is, but for example, imagine this. Say that the Waliyyul Faqih is a researcher in a field, in medicine, for example, and he is the most leading researcher in the field. Naturally, a layman, a normal person, would follow the most knowledgeable. The other researchers would also follow the most knowledgeable of them. So it's the same concept.
Exactly.
You just follow the most knowledgeable person. Very it is not something put, out yeah. of this world. Right, Sheikh? Yeah, would this interpretation be correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And also the book that you mentioned, Walayatul Faqih by Imam Khomeini, may he rest in peace, is available in English and also on the internet, of course.
Yes.
Dear Sheikh, I must end the discussion for today. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadali, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى محن.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.